It's Hurley in the Morning on WPG Talk Radio 95.5.
It is 6 minutes past the hour, and it is my privilege to welcome back. We have had great programs in the past. We have a great Deborah Heart and Lung Center cardiac electrophysiologist who is also the medical director of clinical research at Deborah Heart and Lung Center, Dr. Pedram Kazemian. And the topic this half hour on Deborah Heart and Lung Center Presents is understanding atrial fibrillation. We have a very important topic this half hour. Dr. Pedram Kazemian is an electrophysiologist, is board certified in both cardiovascular disease and clinical cardiac electrophysiology. Dr. Kazemian earned his medical degree and completed his residency in internal medicine at the University of Toronto in Canada. After residency, he completed both a fellowship in cardiology and a fellowship in clinical cardiac electrophysiology at the University of Alberta in Edmonton, Canada. He went on to complete additional fellowship training in clinical cardiac electrophysiology at Brigham and Women's Hospital, Harvard University in Boston, and a fellowship in advanced clinical cardiac electrophysiology at Stewart St. Elizabeth's Medical Center, Tufts University in Boston. Dr. Kazemian's special interests include atrial fibrillation, our topic this half hour, heart failure, and ablations for ventricle tachycardia. He has participated in many clinical research projects and authored numerous articles in peer-reviewed medical journals. Dr. Kazemian, welcome to your program, and we'll get right into the topic. A lot to cover this half hour. Let's start right up front. What is good morning to you, doctor. What is atrial fibrillation?
So atrial fibrillation is the most common arrhythmia in humans. And so heart has an electrical activity and a pacemaker, which determines its rate and regularity. Once this rhythm is out of sync and lost, one of the things that could happen is atrial fibrillation. And during atrial fibrillation, the top chambers of the heart, which are called atria, are not contracting, essentially. Electrically, they are fibrillating, which if you were to look inside the chest and look at the heart, you will see kind of shaking but not really contracting. And the bottom chambers of the heart become irregular and often fast. And this electrical abnormality of the heart is called atrial fibrillation.
What are the risk factors?
So there are many risk factors for atrial fibrillation. Some of them are what we call modifiable risk factors, which mean that we can probably do something about them to reduce them, and some are non-modifiable. So the most common risk factors are hypertension or high blood pressure and heart failure, which is weakening of the heart muscle. But there are other things such as obesity, diabetes, sleep apnea, chronic coronary artery disease, valve diseases of the heart, endocrine abnormalities such as hyperthyroidism, and a host of other things that we do see in many patients. Having said that, in up to about half of the patients who have atrial fibrillation, we may not be able to find any of these risk factors. So they simply increase the risk, but they're not necessarily causative in many of these cases as for atrial fibrillation.
Very important information. Dr. Kazemian, what are the symptoms of AFib?
So as I mentioned previously, what AFib causes is that it makes the top chambers or prevents the top chambers of the heart from contracting. As a result, if you think of the heart as an engine that has four cylinders, imagine two of those cylinders are not working. So it would be an engine that's running on two as opposed to four. So the corollary of that in the heart is that reduced cardiac output. So less blood is pumped out of the heart, and by about 15 to 20%. As a result, less blood gets to brain, muscle, and other organs. So patients feel fatigued, short of breath. Also, as I mentioned, the bottom chamber starts going fast and irregular, so people feel palpitation. They may have dizziness spells. Essentially, they wind it all the time. So they feel tired all the time and fatigued all the time.
Let me bring up something that some people listening right now may deal with from time to time. If someone's heart flutters occasionally, I don't, you know, I'm a layperson, so I don't know if that's like officially a palpitation or whatever, but if they have that little flutter feeling occasionally, is that something to be concerned about? I mean, could that be AFib?
Absolutely. So you mentioned about symptoms of AFib. So a lot of these symptoms that I mentioned are not specific for atrial fibrillation. Other arrhythmias could cause this as well. You can have extra beats that cause this, other causes of rapid heart rate. But as I mentioned, the most common cause of arrhythmia in men is atrial fibrillation. So in patients who have predispositions or risk factors, as I just mentioned previously, especially in elderly, because AFib becomes more prevalent as we get older. So in a younger patient, a 30-year-old, 40-year-old, probably not. But in a 70-year-old, 65, 80-year-old, with those symptoms, yes, definitely AFib would be something that we need to be concerned about, because as we'll hopefully discuss later on, there are risks associated with untreated AFib, including a stroke that can potentially be prevented if diagnosed and treated properly.
We will. That question is going to come up after the first break. Let's get in one more before that break, and we only take one break during DeBora Heart and Lung Center. We'll do it in a few minutes. You talked a bit about it when you talked about less blood to the brain, less blood to the vital organs and things. But what happens specifically within the heart during AFib, and are there different stages?
Yeah, so what happens is the top chambers of the heart, which are atria, stop contracting. So they fibrillate, which is another word for saying that they kind of wiggle around. Fibrillation is Italian for a worm. Essentially, you see a bag full of worms, and that's exactly how it looks like. Is you see some movement on the wall of the top chamber of the heart, but in effect, they're not really contracting. But the bottom chamber goes out of sync as well. But fortunately, it does contract, but contract irregularly and often fast. In terms of different stages, typically when AFib starts, it starts sporadically. We call it paroxysmal AFib. And what it means is that patient may experience a bout of AFib for, say, 10 minutes, a half an hour, maybe an hour or so, that comes and goes and stops on its own. And they may not have another one for a few days, maybe a week, maybe 2 weeks. And then in some percentage of patients, that progresses to what's called persistence. It means that the frequency of the atrial fibrillation, he does come out with a patient to emergency or come to the hospital, the physician with symptoms that are not resolving. Those ones, we bring them to hospital. There are treatments such as cardioversion, which is the shocking the heart essentially out of this rhythm back to normal rhythm, and then other medication, which we'll discuss later. So that's called persistent, which means that it's not resolving spontaneously. And again, some percentage of those patients are persistent over years. They progress to what's called permanent, which is a kind of end stage of it, meaning that the we can't even get those patients at that stage out of AFib, even if we try. Or if they come out for maybe a few minutes and they go back again to it. So those patients will end up staying in atrial fibrillation. Of course, we have to address the other issues, including a stroke prevention in those patients, regardless of whether they're in AFib or out of AFib.
And we're going to talk about that right after the break. We're at 16 minutes past the hour. Very important topic this half hour on DeBora Heart and Lung Center presents Dr. Pedram Kazemian, who is the cardiac electrophysiologist and the medical director of clinical research at DeBora Heart and Lung Center. And our topic this half hour on DeBora Heart and Lung Center presents Dr. Kazemian is understanding atrial fibrillation. Much more important content right after the break, and then we'll be uninterrupted until 35 minutes past the hour when we conclude with a whole lot more important information. And when we come back, exactly what Dr. Kazemian was talking about. How might AFib increase the chance of stroke and heart failure? Very, very important part of today's program coming up next when we come right back. Stay with us with Dr. Kazemian. I am Harry Hurley in the morning. This is WPG Talk Radio 95.5 South Jersey's number one talk station, all because of you. And we know it. We thank you for it.
Summertime at the Jersey Shore. The glitz and glamour of Atlantic City's casinos. Jersey's best pizza on the Ocean City Boardwalk. Great rides in Wildwood. And miles of bumper-to-bumper traffic. WPG Talk Radio 95.5 wants to keep you moving with expanded summertime traffic updates Friday afternoon through your ride back Sunday evening. WPG Talk Radio 95.5, South Jersey's talk station. This is Hurley in the Morning.
Yeah, Harry Hurley. That is a great name.
WPG Talk Radio 95.5 and WPGTalkRadio.com.
Hey, thank you. Welcome back. It's Deborah Heart and Lung Center presents Dr. Pedram Kazemian, cardiac electrophysiologist and the medical director of clinical research at Deborah Heart and Lung Center. And a reminder to make an appointment. It's very simple to do. You can either use the website, which works beautifully. So you can take the digital route at demanddeborah.org, or you can call 609-621-2080. That's 609-621-2080 to make an appointment. Today's topic on Deborah Heart and Lung Center Presents is understanding atrial fibrillation with Dr. Kazemian. So we really are hitting one of the most important questions of your program today, sir, and that is, how might AFib increase the chance of stroke and heart failure?
Yeah, very important question. So unfortunately, up to about a third of all the strokes that occur are because of atrial fibrillation. So it's not a minor issue. And as you can imagine, the stroke is could be very devastating. And typically the strokes that occur in the context of atrial fibrillation are worse in terms of severity than the other types of the stroke. Why does this stroke happen is, as I mentioned, as part of the mechanism of atrial fibrillation, the top chamber of the heart stops contracting, and as a result, the blood becomes stagnant, and the stagnant blood tends to form clot. And if this clot travels to the brain, it manifests as a stroke. Mm. So in patients with atrial fibrillation who have the risk factors for a stroke, being aged, diabetes, hypertension, prior stroke, heart failure, and the like, they are at risk, and they would need to receive blood thinner to prevent the blood clot formation and hence stroke prevention. And the first step is to make sure that we diagnose them properly. So you mentioned an example of somebody who has palpitation, for example, a 7-year-old with hypertension or palpitation. And if that person indeed has atrial fibrillation and is undiagnosed, and is not on blood thinner, he is at considerable risk for neurologic problems, including a stroke.
Wow, very important. What are the types of treatments and medications available for someone who has AFib?
So the medication number one would be anticoagulation. There are many of them available. The old one was warfarin, which many of your listeners are, I'm sure, heard about. But fortunately, we have newer medications that are called novel oral anticoagulants, or NOACs. The benefit of them is that they don't require regular blood work for titration of the dose. You can take them once or twice a day, and they do the trick. They have very little drug-drug interaction and don't interact with food, so it's relatively easy to take them. There are some subpopulation of patients with atrial fibrillation who cannot take anticoagulation. They either have significant risk of bleeding or have already bled. And we do have, actually, we offer it at Deborah, a procedure called the Watchman device implantation. And this will substitute the need for taking anticoagulation. So one way or another, either with medication or consideration for Watchman, we can protect them against a stroke. The second step is that, as I mentioned previously, also one of the manifestations of atrial fibrillation is rapid heart rate. And rapid, if you let the heart run very fast for extended period of time, that causes weakening of the heart muscle or heart failure. So the heart rate has to be adequately controlled.
Let's talk about that for someone listening that might not know. What would constitute rapid heart rate? What are we talking about?
So by definition, a heart rate over 100 beats per minute at rest is considered tachycardia or rapid heart rate.
Important to know.
So, yeah. And there are parameters that we use to determine adequacy of rate control, but that's when you come to the board and we talk in the clinic, we'll go over those things, and we have different ways of controlling that. We have medications, and in some cases, when the medication doesn't work, there may be other things that we can do to control the heart rate.
And again, and lastly, yeah, go ahead. Please, yeah. Continue.
And lastly, the most important one is that the one that patient complain about is the symptoms. As I mentioned, patient with AFib often have symptoms of fatigue, shortness of breath. And none of these things that I mentioned, anticoagulation and rate control, often addresses that issue. And we need to get those patients out of atrial fibrillation, and then keep them out of atrial fibrillation. So we have ablation for atrial fibrillation. We have cardioversion. And in the right patients, if they present early and before anatomic changes occur in the heart, we can have up to 85% success rate of not only getting them to regular rhythm, but keeping them out of atrial fibrillation.
Wow, terrific. That's encouraging. Dr. Kazemian, yes. Is AFib reversible? So you've got it one day. Can it be gone?
Almost. In majority of these patients, it's not reversible, but there is a small population of patients where it is caused by some stimulating factor. For example, a young person goes on binge drinking on Saturday, Sunday, and then coming on Monday in atrial fibrillation. That probably was provoked by the alcohol, excessive alcohol use. And those patients, they don't really have significant risk of a stroke, and they once the AFib resolves, which often does spontaneously, they won't get that again in most cases, unless they try the drinking again at high volume. There are some other causes, such as pericarditis, which is an inflammation of the heart that's sometimes caused by viruses, and that's also reversible. If it's caused by overactive thyroid, when you treat thyroid disease, it will be, taking care of the atrial fibrillation as well. So there are rare cases that happens, but I would say in majority of patients, unfortunately, unless we do something about it, it's not going to be reverted on its own.
What about this? Can you, someone listening right now that doesn't ever want to have this, can you prevent it from happening? Do we have the ability to prevent it?
Well, as I mentioned, we don't know exactly what causes atrial fibrillation, but we know certain risk factors that are contributing to the AFib. Also, as I mentioned, some of those risk factors are modifiable, which means that we can do something about them, and some, unfortunately, are genetic, and we're born with it, and we can't do anything about them. The ones that are modifiable include high blood pressure, so if you can control our blood pressure, would be helpful. Sleep apnea, so that's a condition where patients snore at night and they stop breathing, and that tend to put extra stress on the heart and causes atrial fibrillation. And obviously, we have treatment for that. If it's treated, it definitely reduces the risk of atrial fibrillation. If they have valve disease, we can diagnose those valve disease and treat the valve disease, and often that prevents that. Alcohol consumption, especially high amounts of it, is cardiotoxic, so it's bad for the heart and causes atrial fibrillation. So we can reduce the alcohol consumption or moderate the use of it. And things of that nature. So some of those are reversible causes or things that we can do. Weight loss definitely is an important issue, which we have significant problems, especially in North America, as you know. That's definitely been shown that reduction of weight to normal range reduces the AFib. And not only that, it improves the success of the treatment. So if somebody comes for treatment of AFib, we encourage them and help them to lose weight. And that way we will assure that we have higher success rate in our treatment.
We have about four more minutes in today's program with today's featured Deborah Heart and Lung Center doctor, Dr. Pedram Kazemian. And we're talking about atrial fibrillation. This is also one of the, I think, big questions of your program today, doctor. And that is, and I'm sure a lot of people that are dealing with it want to know this, or could future deal with something like this when they would hear it, that this is something that that they will have to, you know, handle. Can a person with atrial fibrillation live a full, long life?
Absolutely. And that's the important thing is to make a proper diagnosis early on to prevent the sequelae of the disease, the biggest one being a stroke, obviously. And under appropriate treatment, this should not be something that would restrict your lifespan. You should be able to live a fulfilling and healthy life otherwise, without even restriction in terms of your physical activity or physical tolerance.
And let's close with this, and then anything you want to share in the very last moment of your program, the time will be yours for a closing comment of your choice, doctor. But why is it important for people who have heart issues not to delay treatment or care? When, in other words, should you see a doctor?
Yeah, so generally, you know, heart conditions are could be, you know, have significant sequelae for the patient, you know, from major disabilities to a stroke, as I mentioned, to heart attack, to heart failure. But most of these treatments, most of these conditions, we have treatment for nowadays, and but the clue and the cue for the patient to seek medical attention are often symptoms. And it's very important for patients not to ignore symptoms. So if you feel palpitation, if you feel short of breath, if you feel chest pain, that are, you know, out of ordinary, and you've been changing over the past days or weeks, don't wait. Go see your doctor. Come to Deborah. We have cardiologists here. They can be more than happy to see you. Do the test. If everything is normal, you're fine. And if we find something such as atrial fibrillation, intervention earlier is associated with better outcomes. So if you have atrial fibrillation for 10 years, for example, that has not been treated, that success rate of 85% that I told you does not apply. That's for early treatment for patients before the left atrial remodeling and a scar buildup in the left atrium. So the treatments are successful, prevents bad outcome, provided that you patients present early. And that's, you know, they have to take it upon themselves to take that active role in their own diagnosis and treatment.
Which so importantly speaks to what you talked about during your program today. It's like, I think, like most things, cancer, early detection, anything, best outcome is the earliest possible treatment. So that's so important.
Absolutely.
That you leave that as a point of emphasis. Final minute, let me give you a closing comment. Any takeaway that you would like to share on atrial fibrillation?
I would say that the treatment of atrial fibrillation has revolutionized over the past 5-6 years, and it's very important to don't rely on the old literature and the data from say 20-30 years ago. Nowadays we emphasize earlier treatment. We have, as I mentioned, ablation, we have Watchman, we have newer medication. All of them have improved the outcomes with atrial fibrillation and the outcomes for the patient. So it's very important to revisit that if you had old information that you're sort of relying on, and seek opinions of people who are treating this condition with the new information that is available to us.
Our guest this half hour has been Dr. Pedram Kazemian from Deborah Heart and Lung Center, cardiac electrophysiologist and the medical director of the clinical research at Deborah Heart and Lung Center. To make an appointment, two ways. You can call, if you'd like, 609 609- 609-621-2080, 609-621-2080, or use the website demanddebora.org, and you'll be prompted. It's very well laid out. It's easily navigatable right from the website demanddebora.org. Dr. Kazemian, I always enjoy our time together. Really important topic, and you represented it extraordinarily well. Great to visit with you, sir.